This Slate spoiler special is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code SPOILER5.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on The Great Gatsby, the new Baz Luhrmann adaptation of the F. Scott Fitzgerald novel. And joining me in Slate Studios is David Haglund. David, how should I identify you? You're the editor of Browbeat, the culture blog at Slate.
That's right.
Correct?
Yep.
And you're going to write something on The Great Gatsby, the novel.
Yeah, I'm going to write something about the ways that the movie departs from the novel and the ways that it doesn't.
So let's just start off with a yay or nay. How did you feel overall about the movie? Then we'll get into the details.
I enjoyed it. You know, it's an extravagant movie, and some of its extravagances are extravagantly bad, but many of them are extravagantly good. And overall, I had a blast.
Yeah, I have to say, I hated it less than I thought I would. And I tried to go in with a zen mind. I'm not a Baz Luhrmann person. I've essentially, except for Strictly Ballroom, I think pretty much detested all of his movies that I've seen.
Huh.
And so I was not looking forward to this. But I will say that it is 2 hours of immersion in all kinds of visual pleasure, if nothing else.
Right. And I was worried that it would be boring. I had sort of seen a little bit of scuttlebutt here and there on Twitter. And I do think the movie opens a little more slowly than it should, as we can.
Gatsby takes a long time to enter the scene,
and there's this whole frame story which we'll talk about. But so I was worried that it would sort of put me to sleep a little bit, and it definitely didn't do that. I mean,
it definitely catches you up at times in ridiculous ways, and at times in ways that really I don't think do justice to the book. But I mean, can this book really be adequately filmed? That's another whole question. But okay, so let's get into the details. I think we should start by peeling the onion, because this has a frame story around it, as you mentioned, that the novel doesn't have. Do you want to help put it together with me? So we open on Nick Carraway, as we do in the novel, right? The novel's narrator, played by Tobey Maguire here. But there's a twist.
Yeah, he's in a sanitarium, which is just a complete invention of the screenplay. And he's speaking to a therapist of some kind. And we see this doctor filling out forms and noting that Nick is morbidly alcoholic. And he's recovering essentially from this experience that he had in New York.
Right, he has Gatsby PTSD.
Yes, exactly. He's lost his mind, which I actually think on some level is faithful to the spirit of the book. I do think there's a suggestion in the book that Nick is haunted by his experience, that he's really kind of shaken by it. And there's that line early in the book that does not show up in the movie, where he says he wanted the world to be in uniform and at a moral, you know, standing at attention, a moral attention forever, because what he saw was so upsetting. But this sort of sanitarium thing is certainly not at all in the book. And the other thing that this adds is that the doctor tells Nick that he should start writing down his experiences.
And so Nick essentially becomes F. Scott Fitzgerald, right? He writes the story.
He becomes the author. And again, in terms of having just looked at the book, there is a moment where Nick says, the man who gives his name to this book. So Nick does acknowledge the bookishness of what we're reading. But otherwise, I mean, yeah, so we see him first writing things down by longhand. Eventually he switches to a typewriter. It becomes a novel, and he titles it at the end. You know, it says Gatsby, and then he adds with a flourish, he adds by hand, The Great.
Right.
And it says, you know, by Nick Carraway. So it sort of weirdly has become this novel by Nick, which, again, not totally untrue to the spirit of the book, in my opinion, but is an invention and sort of is a way, I think, of as Luhrmann has said in interviews, one of getting some of more of Fitzgerald's language into the movie and having it sort of feel appropriate, because his language is so flowery at times, and also a way of kind of explaining Nick's presence, which does sometimes feel superfluous.
Yeah, well, I mean, Nick is given more to do in this than he is in the 1974 version. I think Sam Waterston plays Nick in that, and he really is just a kind of bland observer. I mean, Tobey Maguire has a pretty big role in this. You really would basically say he's the main character rather than Gatsby, right? He's observing, but he's in almost every scene.
Yeah, and it begins and ends with him, and it's really sort of about his journey in a way. I mean, it's about what this has done to him.
I have to say that the frame story about him writing the novel, although it was nice to have an excuse to throw some of Fitzgerald's sentences in there wholesale, was really hokey, just in the way that any kind of image of an artist at work in a movie can be, especially when Luhrmann chose to do this very splashy thing of having the words at first in Nick's handwriting and later in TypeScript appear on the screen and kind of float through the air around him.
Yeah, overall it feels like a mistake. It doesn't really add enough to the movie. There are nice moments. Like at one point, In the book, Nick says that he's only been drunk twice in his life, which I have to say, in the book, that kind of contradicts the whole idea that he goes on to become a morbid alcoholic, unless he's lying. But in the movie, there's a funny moment where he's writing that by longhand, and you see that he's crossed out once and written twice, as though he has in some ways been in denial about his alcoholism.
Yeah, you're right. That's kind of fun. And then there's a moment that I think that same sentence, he says the second time was that afternoon, right? And then the words that afternoon kind of become like floral. They take on like this print, and it's kind of gaudy and silly, but it's kind of great.
Yeah, the whole thing is gaudy. I mean, the most sort of, I would probably say, ridiculous moment with regard to putting Fitzgerald's language on the screen is when Lerman is trying to deal with this very difficult passage where Gatsby himself, basically, it's not entirely clear whose perspective we're getting when we see this description, but is talking about when he, first kissed Daisy, and is saying that he knew that when he kissed her, his mind would never romp again like the mind of God. It's a line that it is going to be difficult to deal with no matter who you are, Baz Luhrmann or, Terrence Malick or whatever. But that is sort of typed on the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think a shooting star goes by. And I mean, yeah, it's preposterous, but it's also sort of preposterous in the book. I mean, the language of The Great Gatsby itself is so often over the top. So.
Yeah, but literalizing the preposterousness, Well, we can get to that later. But there's also some moments when, as is described in the book, where Gatsby is at the end of his dock, right, reaching across the water, reaching toward the green light that represents Daisy's house on the other side. And just the literal reaching and seeing Leonardo DiCaprio's chubby, beringed hand kind of reaching into the frame just seemed – what does that add to the image of him reaching?
Yeah, not a lot, although I was just glad that it wasn't reaching out to us since the movie's in 3D. I was worried if it could get sort of Leo's hand.
Yeah, we are the green light pursued by Leo's hand.
I mean, I have to say, so that's another sort of aspect of this movie that has kicked up a lot of attention, the fact that he put it in 3D. I thought the 3D was sort of fine. I don't have strong feelings about 3D in general, but I don't know that it added a great deal. There was a lot of the kind of snow and confetti kind of coming out of the screen.
The credit sequence looked kind of neat. There's a moment when we enter into – there's this logo they created, this great Art Deco logo for Gatsby, right? Like a JG for Jay Gatsby. And we kind of enter into it, right? It starts off in black and white looking kind of vintage, like the film is fake scratched up. And then suddenly it goes into this bright color and we kind of zoom into the logo. And that was neat.
Yeah, and at the end you come out of it. So there's this idea that, you're sort of going into this world and then leaving the world. And
yeah,
I thought
it's kind of elegantly framed, I will say. All right, so let's get to Leo DiCaprio, who plays Gatsby. A nice piece of casting, I think.
Absolutely. He's sort of perfect, I think.
Yeah, he really gets it. And I'm not sure he could have done it, 10 or 15 years ago. But now he has some kind of, he has a sadness and gravitas that makes him able to do it.
There's some critic, I can't remember if it was Edelstein or Denby, I think it was one of the Davids, said that DiCaprio, he has this sort of man boy quality. That he's, obviously he was famous as a very young actor and he was so boyish then. And he's grown up in a slightly odd way where you can sort of see the boyish features surrounded by
this.
And I think that's perfect for, and this is the point that one of the Davids makes, I think that's perfect for Gatsby because, there's this idea that he had this sort of, youthful idealism that he has not let go of. Though he's gotten older. And you see that in DiCaprio. And I think that works perfectly.
So the moment he enters is pretty far into the movie, right? And it's a very spectacular party scene. And his entrance is staged really spectacularly. Can you describe that?
This is maybe my favorite moment of the whole movie. So Gatsby lives next to Nick. Nick has taken this little house for $80 a month. And next to Gatsby's mansion. And he finally goes to one of these enormous parties that Gatsby's always throwing. And he's, wandering around. I think in the movie he's already connected with Jordan Baker there, who's a friend of his cousin, Daisy Buchanan.
Right, the golf star.
Yes. So he's seen her, and she's the only person he knows at the party. And then he's hearing these rumors about who Gatsby is. Oh, I heard he killed a man. I heard he's a spy for the Germans or whatever. And then you hear this voice off screen saying, oh, weren't you in the, in the army? I think I recognize you. Someone is saying that to Nick, and you hear him talking. And there's a little flash of you see this ring that in the movie becomes sort of symbolic in some way.
It has the logo on it, doesn't
it? Yeah,
it has
the JG. It has the JG, which I don't think that any specific ring is mentioned in the book, but whatever. I think people, certainly if you know the book, you know that, oh, this is him. But you're not seeing him for a minute or so. And then Nick says, oh, I haven't met Gatsby. And the camera kind of starts to pan up. I don't remember exactly how Lerman does this, but right up to Leo's big, beautiful face, and we haven't seen it yet. And he says, but I'm Gatsby. And as he's saying this, Rhapsody in Blue, which has been playing in the background, like hits the big, you know.
The big
climax, the moment you remember from, you
and
know,
fireworks
Woody Allen's
start
Manhattan,
to go off.
And fireworks are just going off like crazy blue fireworks in the background.
See, I thought that moment was so cheesy.
I loved it. I thought it was perfect. I mean, it is cheesy. It's
just the use of Rhapsody in Blue is just sort of, you know, what's the very first piece of music you think of when you think of the jazz age? Rhapsody in Blue. It just seemed like a very obvious music choice that's kind of been stolen by Woody Allen and other people who have used it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so familiar. But at the same time, I mean, that for me, I mean, the book feels like that, too. It's just this is, I guess, you know, another approach would be to somehow try to make it new rather than to kind of revel in all of the connotations that it has taken on over the years. I think Lerman does more of the latter. But I think that works because it's impossible to come to this story without thinking about everything that's been said about it since. You know, there's just so much association with it. So I mean, it just worked. That's such a great piece of music. And yes, you've heard it a million times. But it somehow seemed fitting to me. And it seemed in keeping with the idea, just his whole self-presentation, that DiCaprio as Gatsby, you know, he's trying to be something that he's not. So he is borrowing things, right? He is borrowing, like, his idea of what a rich man should be. And so somehow that piece of music seemed like the one that should be playing in the background.
Yeah, I don't know that I have any real basis for my criticism of his choice of Rhapsody in Blue, except that it was just sort of like, oh, please. But it's also very atypical with the rest of Lerman's music choices because most of them were completely anachronistic, right? They weren't 20s music at all. There was Jay-Z and Kanye and what else was on the soundtrack? Alicia Keys.
There's a lot of Lana Del Rey. She has this song, you know, Will You Still Love Me When I'm No Longer Young and Beautiful.
Was it written for this movie?
I think it was. It's at least sort of being premiered with on the soundtrack, I think. And it runs throughout because you sometimes hear it sung, but you also hear the melody a fair amount. And he plays around a bit with – there's Beyoncé song, Crazy in Love, but it's done by the Brian Setzer Orchestra or something. I mean, it's sort of like a jazz
– Brian Ferry, right?
Brian Ferry. It's like a jazz version of that song. So you hear that as well. So he's kind of mixing the present, you know, sort of contemporary music with something that sounds vaguely like music of the time.
Yeah. And there, I mean, I have no – that's an interesting approach. It doesn't always work, but it's cool, and the soundtrack would be great to own.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the party scene in general is done pretty well. So, I mean, this book is basically a series of big set pieces. The first one, after that frame story with Nick in the hospital, which Lerman added, is when Nick goes to the Buchanan's and he sees – Daisy and Tom and meets Jordan. The next one, I believe, is either the big party at the apartment or this party at Gatsby's. But, you know, it's just kind of a series of these kind of grandly staged
So it's
things.
Kind of made for Baz Luhrmann in a way, right? I mean, even though I think the tone departs significantly from that of the book, which is this very, you know, delicate sort of tone.
See,
poem.
I disagree. I think that the book is purple and gaudy and loud. And so the movie, to me, while not all of its attempts to do that visually worked, I actually think it's
But the book
really
is
the
also
book.
Dreamlike, right?
Yes,
the book
yes,
is dreamlike,
yes.
And the movie, just by virtue of being a movie, but also by virtue of being a Baz Luhrmann movie, literalizes everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for instance, that moment we were just talking about with DiCaprio, it's you know, sort of understated in the book. I mean, just, oh, I'm Gatsby. You know, I mean, but how do you... Exactly. I mean, when you do it visually, you have to... I mean, it's a whole different... It's a fascinating study in adaptation for that reason. Because, you know, in a book, you can leave such moments sort of to the reader's mind in a way. But in a movie, you can't. You have to convey what's happening visually. And Gatsby has such an effect on Nick. That's, you know, that's the point. I mean, that he sort of, there's something about him, there's something about the way he looks at you and the way he talks to you that makes you feel special because you're with him.
That's something I think is really well done, actually. I think the best relationship in this movie is the Gatsby-Nick relationship, more so than what happens between Carey Mulligan and Leonardo DiCaprio, which a lot of it feels like I can see the dialogue on the page, you know, or
right.
on the book's pages.
Yeah, what did you think of Carey Mulligan as Daisy?
I mean, I actually think it's a kind of a terrible part for an actress to play. She looks the part. She looks incredible. I don't think she gets to do a heck of a lot.
Right.
And Mia Farrow was sort of in the same boat in the earlier adaptation. You know, they have to represent something, right? Her voice sounds like money, a line that I kept waiting for from the book that never, ever happens in the movie. But she is more of a symbol of the unattainable and of, you know, wealth and desire and all these things than an actual character.
Yeah, although I thought Lerman and his co-screenwriter, Craig Pierce, I think is his name, did a pretty good job of conveying, Daisy's knowledge of that, right? She's aware on some level that these men are making symbols of her. And there's the whole thing where eventually Gatsby says, you know, she falls back in love with Gatsby, you know, when he comes back after like another great set piece, the one at Nick's house with the tea, which we should talk about. But she falls back in love with him, but then Gatsby insists that she tell Tom that she never loved him. Right, that's crucial to him, that she has always only loved Gatsby.
Which is also directly from the book, right?
Yes,
that scene where they all go
faithful.
Get drunk at the plaza and they have that horrible
So good.
Row.
See, there's so much, they're great scenes in the book, but I think they're well realized. And that's another one. But she and she tells Gatsby, look, I can't do that. You're asking too much. Like, I did love him. I'm a person. I'm not this idea that you have. And I think that kind of vision of Daisy is pretty well conveyed in the movie. And I think, I liked her performance. That there are times that work better than others. I think that she's an interesting actress because she does have this – I loved her voice. I was amazed, too, that the line about it sounding like money never came up because I thought she nailed it just in terms of the sound of Daisy. But actually, she also can do sort of plain and mousy. And, you know, it's sort of surprising when – I don't know. Daisy is this idea, so you kind of expect her to look and be a certain way the whole time, and Mulligan is a little more complicated than that. But I think overall it works well.
Practically all the casting choices worked really well.
Yeah. Jordan Baker, whoever this actress is, Elizabeth Debicki, I guess she's Australian or something.
I spent the whole time thinking, is that Rooney Mara? Because she looks sort of like a taller Rooney Mara.
A taller, a stronger Rooney Mara.
I seriously thought, is Rooney Mara walking on some sort of higher track so that she looks taller than Tobey Maguire?
But she really, I mean, if you scoured the world for someone who looks like the Jordan Baker described in this book.
Yeah, and the descriptions of Jordan Baker in the novel are so great. She's one of my favorite characters in the book just because who doesn't know someone like Jordan Baker, you know, this impenetrably cool person.
Yes, exactly. Although, you know, one small departure from the book is that the relationship between her and Nick is not fleshed out at all in the movie. I mean, in the book they become romantically involved. It's not a hugely important part of the story, but it is part of the story, and I think that probably Lerman decided he didn't have time.
Yeah, Tobey Maguire didn't get any action at all. Well,
right.
I guess that one night, the one drunken day.
Yes, so that's another set piece, the apartment party where Tom takes Nick into town with Myrtle, Isla Fisher.
Who's his mistress.
Yeah, his mistress, and he has an apartment for her in the city, and so they're going to have a party, and she's going to invite her sister, and they're going to have a riotous good time. Another thing that is, I think, basically true to the spirit of the book, but which they take a lot of liberties. If I'm not mistaken, Nick in the movie is slipped some kind of pill, right, by this woman. She kind of gives him something and says, "Oh, I get it from a doctor in Queens." None of that happens in the book. There are no pills involved. It's just a lot of drinking. And then at the end, he says, "Oh, I don't know how I got home." And you see him kind of in his underwear outside. In fact, he took the train. But he did get drunk and kind of wake up next to a guy. You know, it feels – maybe my second favorite moment in the movie takes place in that scene when he's looking out the window. And this is, I think, actually one of the best uses of 3D. He's looking at all – it looks like Rear Window. It looks like Hitchcock's Rear Window. And he's looking at all these scenes in different apartments. And they're sort of – popping out of the building, and he talks about how he feels like he's both, you know, an observer and observed. And
is that text all from the book too? I'm within and without.
Within and without.
At the same time?
Yeah. I think, you know, that sort of some of the text has moved around, and there are things that Nick says in one place that it's put in another place in the movie. But that thing about being within and without is directly from the book.
Yeah, that is a nice use of 3D and just a nice use of the kind of crazy camera movements that Baz Luhrmann always likes. You know, there's a lot of weird zooms out of the city and, you know, then back to Tobey Maguire. And he's doubled. He sees himself outside and inside the building. And it's kind of kooky, but it's kind of great.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, in terms of just the over-the-topness of this movie, there's also a black man with a saxophone wailing on a, on a patio. I mean, everything is sort of just then turned up another notch.
Well, there's definitely an argument to be made. It's a very 20s thing, but I don't think it's particularly interrogated by Luhrmann. But there's a lot of exoticizing of, you know, Josephine Baker-like black dancers and that black saxophonist or trumpeter or whatever he is on the roof.
So I actually thought – so this is from the book, and I thought Luhrmann actually – I give him a lot of credit for this. I think that he very deliberately kept in those moments. So, for instance, at that first lunch at the Buchanan's, Tom goes on about this book by a guy named Goddard, I think, called The Rise of the Colored Empires, I think it was. It's a real book, if I'm not mistaken. I'll have to Google this later. But it's this sort of horribly racist tome about how, you know, colored people are taking
over. Some kind of eugenic modernist
thing. Like, you know, I mean, it's a white supremacist book. And Tom brings this up in the book, and then later there's a scene where they're going into the city and Nick notices these very well-dressed black people having champagne or something. Also in the movie, that's that scene. In that case, it's scored to some Jay-Z song. I can't remember which one. I actually think Luhrmann was sort of calling attention to that aspect of the book in an intelligent way, that this is partly about, you know, this kind of white fear of the way the world is changing.
So that moment when they see the well-dressed group of black people having champagne is in the book?
Is in the book.
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's worded. I mean, where Fitzgerald comes down in all this, it's not entirely clear. I mean, certainly he uses language that we wouldn't now. He talks about sort of the $2 in the back of the car or whatever. But it is this idea that he's seen these kind of – in fact, I think in the book they might have a white driver. I mean, it is deliberately this kind of –
they
reversal.
Have a white driver in the movie.
They do. Oh, there you go. So it's deliberately this reversal of racial expectations. And I think maybe Nick in the book says something like, you know, in the city anything is possible. It's sort of this idea that things are topsy-turvy and, you know, everything's changing. And I thought because he put in those scenes and that dialogue about, you know, this book that Tom's reading, when you see the, you know, Josephine Baker-like dancers at these – it's in your mind. You're aware of kind of – the, you know, you're aware of the racism at play in a way.
Right, and that there's another world coexisting kind of beneath the surface of theirs that they don't really know anything about.
Yeah, and are sort of, you know, like you said, exoticizing. And I mean, another instance of that I think he handles sort of interestingly, Luhrmann does, is Meyer Wolfsheim. Because Meyer Wolfsheim is the gangster that
the Jewish financier in the book, right?
That Gatsby's involved with,
who's a very anti-Semitic, oily kind of characterization in the book.
Absolutely, and it's another thing about the book that's sort of uncomfortable. That, you know, I mean, Fitzgerald's depiction of him, I don't think you can call it anything but anti-Semitic. Like, there's all this attention to his nose and his hair in this sort of weird way. And Luhrmann cast this Indian actor,
Amitabh Bachchan, right? A huge Bollywood superstar.
Yeah, who's I think great and very good at the part, and he gets. I mean, Luhrmann is kind of saving Fitzgerald a little bit in a way because he conveys the otherness to, you know, to Gatsby and Nick of this character without making it anti-Semitic.
Yeah, it's true. That's kind of a racially unmarked characterization, right? But the mere fact that he's Indian kind of throws the whole thing off.
Yeah, and you're aware of that. So that it's, you know, again, with this kind of Rise of the Colored Empires book in the back of your mind, it's like, oh, okay, well, here's this, you know, this man from the underworld, and he's not white, and you notice that, and that's, you know, significant and called attention to.
All right, well, we have more set pieces that I want to get to, but let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. This episode of the Slate Spoiler Special is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project. Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. And they add 10,000 new video clips each week, so every time you visit, you'll find something new. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account, no credit card needed. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save the video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use the offer code SPOILER5 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com. And again, for 30% off a new account, you just use the offer code SPOILER5. Spoiler special thanks Shutterstock for their support. All right, so back to Gatsby. So we haven't really talked about the look of the movie, which is hugely important. It was really my favorite thing about it. I mean, even though I had more eye-rolling than you, I think, at some of the, I thought, the points that were hit overly hard, I was completely wrapped up in just the lushness and the design of the whole thing. And fascinatingly, the production designer and the costume designer is the same person, Catherine Martin, who must have been one busy woman during that shoot.
Yeah, incredibly busy, although maybe that helps explain how of a piece it all feels. I mean, everything is sort of, you know, from Gatsby's pink suit to, you know, the look of the lawns. I will say the one aspect of the production design that I couldn't quite get into was the look of both Nick's place and, to some extent, the look of Gatsby's.
The interiors,
No, the exterior. So, like, I mean, Nick, you know, this sort of modest house is apparently in the Enchanted Forest or something. I mean, there's all of these
It's like the dwarf's cottage or something.
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe he wanted to have enough with sort of the shadows. And it is summer, so, you know, it's everything is lush. But it felt a little bit like something out of Disney. And likewise, Gatsby's own mansion sort of
looks like the Disney castle.
It looks like
bit.
The Disney castle. Which, you know, I will say, I mean, you mentioned before all of Lerman's zooms. There are a few kind of across the, you know, across
the
water.
The harbor separating West Egg and East Egg.
Which I didn't quite do it for me. It felt a little bit goofy.
Yeah, I mean, there's just, there always has to be, you can't look at something in this movie without either racing toward it, right? Or having it pop out and be thrown at you. To me, that got to be too much. I mean, our producer was just pointing out, and he's kind of right, that Gatsby probably would have done it this way, that Gatsby himself is kind of Lerman-esque in his vulgar tastes, and he would have loved to be backed up by Rhapsody in Blue.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, I've seen some criticism of the movie that, in just the, you know, the very early reviews that, I think maybe this is Denby, says that, you know, well, you know, Fitzgerald is ultimately sort of critical of this vulgarity. But I don't think that's quite accurate. I mean, he preserves some idealism about Gatsby himself, right? And there's that scene at the end where Nick says, you know, you're worth all of them put together.
They're a rotten crowd.
Yeah, they're a rotten crowd.
Which is verbatim in the movie,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think done pretty well. And he sort of waves to him. And you even get, I thought this was sort of unnecessary, but it's fine. You get Nick's thought, again, direct from the book, that he was glad that he said that because it was the only time he ever complimented him. But so there is some way in which I think that, you know, fairly vulgar imagination is respected on some level. You know, like, I mean, this movie, it's obviously so much about money, and Gatsby didn't have it, and he wanted it. And, you know, Fitzgerald ultimately doesn't condemn quite that that idea. Or maybe he blames the rest of the world for it, not Gatsby himself. But, like, that desire to have beautiful things.
It's Gatsby's form of transcendence in the book, right? And so it is respected in that sense. It's like his desires may be shallow and infatuous and overly focused on wealth, but it's not his fault in a way.
Right. And exactly. And I think that, you know, what's the fault is Tom and Daisy who were born into money and who have this carelessness that is ultimately what's really damned is these wealthy people who live without consequences and who make a mess of other people's lives. That's what really bothers him.
Well, since we got to that, I think we should get to the car crash and the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg and the whole Valley of Ashes. If you've read the book, you know what we're talking about, the kind of violent climax of the movie. How did you think that worked as compared to the book and just as a piece of film?
I mean, it's another, you know, beautiful bit of production design. I mean, there's no mistaking it for anything but, you know, a Valley of Ashes. It's really kind of just, you know, sooty and grimy.
And we should mention, in case you haven't read the book or haven't read it in a long time, this Valley of Ashes is essentially the sort of poverty-stricken stretch that separates wealthy East Egg and West Egg, Long Island, the fictional communities that they live in from Manhattan. So every time they make a jaunt into the city, they have to cross through the Valley of Ashes.
Right. It's in Queens, basically. And it's, you know, sometimes people fail to realize that, you know, at the time that Fitzgerald was writing, Long Island was not anything near as developed as it is now. So, you know, East Egg and West Egg are actually not that far away from the city. They're not out in the Hamptons. They're relatively close. So that, yeah, there's this, you know, industrial stretch that they have to cross through when they actually go into Manhattan. And then there's the billboard, which is, you know, some old faded oculist, some eye doctor has put up these two eyes. And I thought that was sort of just beautifully beautifully designed. It looks a bit like the original cover for the book. And I thought, you know, Isla Fisher as Myrtle, you know, has the requisite kind of, you know, sort of voluptuous vitality, manages to convey that on screen anyway. And then,
Jason Clarke in a small role as her husband is great, I think.
Yeah, I see. I thought it was maybe like a little bit hammy, but you know, generally
but
good.
But in keeping with the mood of the movie.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, everyone's hammy. So, and then ultimately, you know, one night after, you know, Gatsby and Tom have had their throwdown and he said, you know, Daisy must say she never loved you, and she refuses. And then he and Daisy are driving back together, angrily. Myrtle sees the car, thinking that it's Tom, and comes out to, you know, to stop him.
Why would she think that the yellow convertible is Tom's? He's never driven that car.
He's driving it on the way in.
Oh, you're right. They switched cars.
They switched cars. So the idea, I think, is that, yeah, that she saw them go into town and Tom was in that car. And the idea, I mean, it's a very recognized, it's this incredibly, you know, lavish, expensive, I think maybe even sort of personally made, custom made car. So and it's this bright yellow. So you would recognize it immediately. And she runs out to stop it and they slam right into her. And it's, you know, one of these extravagant moments, which I think basically worked for me. But, you know, there I did find myself sort of pausing and kind of waiting to cringe because you just know that
you know there's going to be slow-mo body
slow,
flying through the air.
Yeah,
slow,
and she's kind of flying through the air, and there's kind of glass coming at you, possibly in 3D. And you see it a couple of times, I think. Maybe because there's a flashback. They're describing the scene. But again, I mean, that's another moment that's pretty over the top in the book as well. I mean, the thing I was glad Lerman didn't do is in the book you get a pretty graphic description of her left breast being torn off and kind of flapping. It's horrible. And you know, fortunately, Lerman spares us that. We see her dead, but it's, you know, relatively decorous.
You know, I think I feel about the car crash about like I feel about the rest of the movie, which is that I sort of watched it with this combination of eye-rolling and ecstasy, you know?
Right.
I mean, at once I was sort of thinking, we get it, Boz, especially when we revisit the slow-mo Isla Fisher flying through the air, hitting the car. You know, he really has to just hit everything so hard. And, you know, there's moments when Tobey Maguire's narration will say one thing and then Leonardo DiCaprio's dialogue will basically repeat it, right?
Right.
So Toby says in voiceover, you know, we had a serious talk about his past. And then next thing you know, Leo's saying, old sport, let's have a serious talk about the past. You know, there was way too much of that kind of doubling. But that said, I was kind of enraptured for 2 hours. I mean, we saw this at the Ziegfeld, at this beautiful Art Deco palace in New York. And, you know, you're sitting in a red velvet seat listening to Rhapsody in Blue and being wrapped up in these incredible flapper costumes. How can you not be caught up in it?
They even gave us free popcorn.
I didn't have any of the free popcorn. I should have, that would have completed my movie experience.
Yeah, I mean, people should definitely make an evening of this and just enjoy the spectacle. I do think there were times when he took me out of it by just going, you know, trying something that just ended up not working. So the most egregious example of this for me is at one point, I mean, it's in that conversation, I think, that serious conversation.
On the dock,
which I just in general was sort of one of the weaker scenes, I thought, you know, sort of cutting between the two of them. And it just didn't quite grab
me. This is Gatsby and Nick on the dock.
Gatsby and Nick.
About.
And then
light a flash in the whole time. Another thing that was hit too hard. I mean,
yes,
the green light is a huge theme in the book as well, but
it
we
is.
Don't need to see it every 10 minutes and talk about it.
Right. And then in this case, Nick wants to know what Gatsby's letter to Daisy said, that, you know, before she got married, you know, because they had met when they were teens and he had to go off into the war and she was going to wait and then she didn't. And so he wants to know what this letter said. And for some reason, Lerman decides to show us Daisy reading the letter sort of in the clouds. And so you get her hair kind of flowing over, because it's longer than when she's younger, kind of flowing over her head and fading into the clouds. And all I could think of was Mufasa in The Lion King appearing to his son. I mean, that's what it looks like. And then you get the kind of handwritten bit of the letter saying, "I'm penniless," which I think he added. I'll have to check that. I just started to chuckle a little bit in my seat. At the same time, I thought, well, you know, he's going to just throw it all up there and some of it will work and some of it won't.
Yeah, anytime letters were floating in the air, unfortunately, I could just really not get behind it, even when the words, the sentences that the letters were saying were beautiful.
Yeah, and in fact, I think Edelstein maybe referred to the alphabet soup that you, mm-hmm. you do. You get something like alphabet soup on the screen.
Alphabets with little marshmallows floating.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to the ending since we're spoiling and talk about what happens to the whole gang after the car crash.
Right. So after the crash, Tom, and this is something another thing I think Lerman does well, where, you know, departing from the book, you actually see Tom tell Wilson, his mistress's husband, that it was Gatsby who was driving the car. And, oh, maybe it was Gatsby who was sleeping with his wife, because Wilson has started to – he's realized that something's going on. He noticed that somebody had bought her a necklace or something, and he wants to get her out west. So Tom makes him think that not only was it Gatsby driving the car, but it was probably Gatsby sleeping with his wife. And actually, this Gatsby character is shady. I think he's a criminal. You know, someone should do something about him. So he plants this idea in Wilson's mind. Wilson takes a gun, goes over to Gatsby's mansion, finds him in his pool, which you get straight from the book. Although one detail I was sad to see left out is that in the book, Gatsby has gotten an inflatable floater for the pool and is, you know, floating along. Instead, what Lerman does is have, you know, Leo put on an old-fashioned swimsuit and dive majestically into his pool and then rise out of it and then get, you know, plugged in the back by Wilson and his gun, who then shoots himself. And that, again, it was another scene where I was kind of, you know, on the edge of my seat. Is he going to screw this up? Because you get this, it's, you know, slow motion again, if I'm not mistaken, and you get this close up on Leo's face sort of as he's dying.
And don't forget the phone call, the suspense right. about the phone call, right? Which is intercut in a way that I don't think happens in the novel, does
I don't,
it?
Yeah, I'll need to check. I don't think so.
So he's waiting for a phone call from Daisy, Gatsby is,
right.
thinking delusionally that the two of them are going to run away together and escape this whole car crash. And instead, the phone does ring just as he's about to be shot, as he's emerging from the pool, but it turns out to be Nick.
Yeah, to be Nick. I think that's all added. I think it works well. It gives the sort of dignity to his death, because he thinks that Daisy has called him, and at the moment of his death, he thinks that, you know, it's all going to work out in the end after all. And then, you know, he falls away into the pool. So it's another of these moments that sort of vastly melodramatic, but it's a fairly melodramatic story.
Yeah, the Leo slowly sinking. I have to say, yeah, I have no problem with that ending. As over the top as it was, the kind of operatic moment that he's sinking. I can't remember what the music is in the background, but the music is pretty intense there too. I think it is soundtrack music, not a pop song.
Yeah, I think so. And then you see him kind of drifting in the water there for a moment, and there's sort of light coming up from some mysterious source, and then I think cuts to his funeral, which is done a little differently. I mean, there's this whole thing about Nick trying to get anyone to come, and nobody will. I mean, you know, Gatsby, that's the whole idea, right? That he was surrounded by all these fancy people, but he didn't actually have any friends. So no one will come to his funeral. I think in the book there's actually one person who shows up. And if I'm not mistaken, it might be the guy that they meet in the library earlier on. And I kind of wondered if that character he was so elaborately bearded and bespectacled, that guy. I thought for sure we would see him again. I wonder if he got cut.
Yeah, that was sort of like the planted gun in the first act that never goes off, that guy.
Yeah.
So then the next thing we see, or the last, almost last thing we see, is Tom and Daisy's story wrapping up, right? The careless Buchanans who are going off with their daughter, who we see only once. She actually makes more appearances in the book than she does in the movie, right? She's completely taken care of by nurses, and her mother seems completely indifferent to her. The three of them are taking off for Europe, escaping their own sins, essentially. And that's the last we see of them.
Yeah, and Nick calls trying to get Daisy to come to the funeral, and their servant, whoever it is, won't even pass the phone to her. They're sort of shushing him off. And I thought, you know, Edgerton, I think, is great. He's perfect.
Joel Edgerton.
Joel Edgerton.
Tom Buchanan.
He's perfectly cast, this kind of hulking man, as Tom Buchanan is described. And I think he gets the voice right. And the other interesting thing is, he's a horrible person, Tom Buchanan. But in one of the challenges of the story is the idea that, you know, that Daisy falls for him on some level, that there's something. And I actually think that that came across pretty well in those final scenes, first in the scene when she refuses to tell Gatsby that she never loved him, and then when they're going off. I mean, Daisy herself is, you know, kind of horrible on some level as well. And, you know, he's impressive enough in the movie that you feel like, oh, sure, she could be swept off.
Yeah, he has that brute animal force that Fitzgerald describes, right? Which is the thing that draws her to him.
And there's that scene when that showdown. I think it's at the plaza when Gatsby tries to get Daisy away from him and you know, claim her finally for himself. He has a great job of riling up Gatsby, of putting him down in this way that he knows he can because he has old money and Gatsby's nouveau riche and vulgar, and he kind of just, you know, jabs him with that over and over again until Gatsby just snaps. And there's a line that comes straight from the book where Nick says it looked in that moment like maybe he did kill a man, which was this rumor about him. And that clearly, I mean, that's sort of the end. That's the mirage has vanished. And even Daisy sees, okay, there's something a little bit scary about this guy. It's completely over the top. I mean, DiCaprio kind of goes crazy, but it works.
Let's talk about the very ending and the very famous last sentence, and you know how that last moment of reaching for the green light is staged.
Yeah, again, you know, this is some of that language clearly that Lerman, you know, wanted, needed to get into the movie, and so made part of, you know, Nick's book. And so you see him typing away, and then you see that those famous last lines about how I should just read it, right? I've got the book in front of me. It's short. He says, these are the lines that we actually get in the movie, is that these last two paragraphs says, Gatsby believed in the green light, which, of course, we see again in that moment. Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning, so we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. So that last sentence is, you know, typed out on the screen over
the
stars.
Sky,
yeah,
right?
Over stars. There might be another shooting star in there. There are a few of them. And then we see Nick, you know, put his manuscript all together into a box, I think, and it says Gatsby, the title, and then he scrawls over it, the great, on top. And I believe it fades out, is my memory.
So the last we see is the top page of his manuscript?
I think so. It's because then the title of it with that handwritten, the great, and then Gatsby kind of like it's sort of at the center of the screen. It's sort of superimposed. I don't remember it precisely, but that's my lasting image of the kind of finale there.
To me, that is just one layer of hoke too many. I mean, already, I'm glad the last sentence is in there. You know, I don't begrudge him just stealing that great prose and tacking it onto the end of the movie. I'll even accept it being printed against the sky. But then when we go back to Tobey Maguire neatly stacking his papers, I don't know. It adds – it's not just that it's too much. It's that I don't think that is true to the end of the book exactly. It's like a sense of accomplishment or something. Like, I've become a writer. That doesn't seem to have anything to do with.
Right, exactly. And actually, there's another there's a way in which the characters keep referring back to Nick as someone who's going to be a writer in a way that I think is added. I mean, he says in the book that he was a literary man at Yale and he sort of had these ambitions, but that's sort of hit on again and again. And yeah, you get a sense that, oh, now he has accomplished that.
Right. It turns the book into like a Bildungsroman in a way that it completely isn't, you know?
Yeah. It doesn't really seem necessary. I mean, I think you could have gotten that language in. You could have had that voiceover. You know, I think movie audiences are pretty used to over-the-top voiceovers. They don't have to sound like natural speech all the time. So I did ultimately feel like that was sort of a mistake.
But overall, you would still send people to this movie without reservation?
Absolutely. I'll probably go back myself.
I will probably see it again, too. I wish I could see it again before writing on it to sort of figure out how it's all put together. But I think I would sit through it with considerably more eye rolling than you.
And more popcorn this time.
Yeah, maybe popcorn will help the second time around. Okay, David, thanks so much for coming in. Let's spoil another movie soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Dana.
Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.